he looked. But I didn't look nothing like Spoonie. Nothing. I mean, I wear jeans and t-shirts, and he wears jeans and t-shirts. So we look alike in that way. But who doesn't wear jeans and t-shirts? Every kid in my school does, and sneakers, and sweatshirts, and jackets. So what exactly does a kid who looks like me look like? Seriously, what the hell? You would think I would cut the TV off, but I didn't. Maybe because there was something about having this moment in my life, literally hovering above my head, that served as some kind of weird inspiration for the picture I was making. So, as usual, I muted it, then dove into my art. Oatmeal for breakfast, chicken burrito for lunch, ginger ale, art in between it all. Clarissa had been in and out of the room checking my vitals, checking to make sure I was eating and using my spirometer, checking to see how the piece was coming along. "It's gonna be so good when it's done," she said, jotting down my blood pressure. She looked exhausted. "You work every day?" I asked, shrugging off her compliment. It's not that I was trying to be rude, I just didn't really know if good was how this piece was actually going to end up. "I have been. I usually work every other day, 12-hour shifts, but I took on some extra work this week covering for a friend." It wasn't hard to tell that that's just how Clarissa was. A for real nice person. So when she brought the lunch in, I told her how thankful I was that she had been looking after me and how happy I was that she had taken those extra shifts. My mother always raised me to be thankful. She always said nobody owes you anything, so when you get something, be appreciative. And I was. "I mean, I know it's your job, but you're really good at it, so thanks." Clarissa flashed a smile that slipped into an unexpected yawn. "It's my pleasure. Just trying to add a little sunshine," she said, lifting a hand to her mouth. She was so sweet, but man, was she corny. "I hear you. Well, you're doing that. Every time you come in here, you brighten the whole room up. Maybe it's the hair." The red hair up against her pale skin, like fire burning at the end of a match. "Ah, yes, ginger magic," she joked. "You know, I'm the last of a dying breed." "What you mean?" "I mean gingers. Redheads. We're going extinct."
"Seriously? Like, something is killing y'all?"
"Not exactly. It's like, not enough redheads are having babies with other redheads, so we're just not being born anymore," Clarissa laughed, then glanced up at the muted TV. Her eyes narrowed. "Check it out."
I looked up, reluctantly, and there on the screen was the police chief. So I unmuted. We listened. He didn't really say much except that they were investigating everything and that he had the utmost faith in Officer Galuzzo's judgment and that the officer was a veteran with an immaculate record.
"Yeah, I bet," Clarissa said. Then, noticing me taking it all in, she added, "Hey, don't let the bastards get you down."
"Yeah."
"You know that song?"
"What song?"
"Don't let the bastards,"
she stopped, grinned.
"Never mind."
When Ma showed up, the TV was still unmuted, and the story was still developing, and I was still drawing.
"Knock, knock,"
Ma said, tapping the door frame. Clarissa had asked me if I wanted the door open or closed, and I told her open. It just seemed like a good idea to let some air in, or maybe let some of the suffocating feeling of the room out. "Hey," I said, now a bed remote expert, adjusting it so that I was sitting more upright.
"How you feeling?" Ma asked, coming in. She was alone.
"I'm fine, just doing some drawing," I told her. "Where's Dad?"
She kissed me on the forehead, then sat on the side of the bed. He couldn't make it. Something upset his stomach, and he was throwing up all night.
"Is he okay?"
Yeah, he's fine," she said.
She dug in her purse, pulled out an envelope, and set it on the side table.
"This came to the house for you."
"Who's it from?"
"It's from Chief Killebrew."
I nodded, but didn't say anything. I figured it was a get-well-soon card or something like that. Couldn't even read it because my mother was way more concerned with more pressing issues.
"Have you eaten?"
"Yes, Ma, I ate breakfast and lunch," I said with a groan. I knew this was only the beginning of the mother questions. It's like all moms have a checklist that they read through to make sure their kids are okay. Number one, have you eaten? the most important one. Number two, are you hungry? Not to be confused with number one and asked even if you say you've eaten. Number three, have you pooped? Just to make sure you're eating the right stuff. Number four, have you bathed? And if you're my mom, number five, what are you drawing? I handed her the notebook. She looked at it and instantly started to get emotional, her eyes tearing up. She was blinking them back when a clip of Claudia James, the lady who taped the whole thing, came back on the screen. My mother watched, still holding the sketch pad. You know, some people think the cop was justified. They say he was just doing his job, I said, darting my eyes from the TV to my mother. She looked at me. Her face looked like it was made of clay, like it could crack at any second. His job, she said, the tears finally dropping. You are not a criminal, Rashad. I know that. I know every word you said was true. You didn't deserve this. You're not a criminal, she repeated. I could feel the heat rising in the room. In her. I didn't know how she had been dealing with this at home or if she and Dad had been getting into it or what. But in that moment, the water in the kettle had finally started to boil in front of me. My mother was steaming. You're not some animal that they can just hunt. You're not some punching bag, something for them to beat on whenever they feel like it, she said, slapping my sketchbook down. She continued to lose her battle with the tears. This is not okay, she said. It was the first time I had ever heard her say it. Usually it was Spoony. It's not okay. The TV cut back to the police chief. He said Galuzzo would be placed on paid leave until they got to the bottom of this. My mother clenched her jaw as the chief spoke. Then they flashed Galuzzo's face on the screen. Ma's breath caught when she saw his mug on the screen. That asshole, she growled. Here's the thing. My mother almost never curses. I think I may have heard her say damn maybe once, but that's really it. She's just not that type. So to hear her say asshole let me know how angry she really was, that this thing was breaking her down inside too. I'm sorry, she said immediately, trying to get back to mom mode. She reached over and grabbed a napkin off my food tray to pat her face dry. I'm sorry, she said again, forcing a crooked smile, which she was only able to keep up for about 5 seconds, yikes, before crumbling into pieces. She was sobbing and panting, short and choppy, dabbing at her pouring eyes and nose with the napkin. It was like everything she had been holding in was now finally coming out. I leaned forward and inched myself closer to her. Each small movement felt like a knife blade pushing into my side. But I didn't care. I had to get to her. Then my arms were around her, and now I was crying, my body burning on the inside while I told her over and over again, it's okay. It's okay. I'm gonna be fine. And as she pulled away to blow her nose once more, working as hard as she could to paint that half-full smile back on her face, I reached out for the remote and, please work, please work, please work, changed the channel. Spoony showed up about an hour later with Barry. My mother and I had calmed down and were watching Family Feud, laughing at some of the stupid answers people were coming up with. Name something you might find under your bed. A monster! Nah, they don't hide under there no more. Or in closets, Spoony said, making an entrance as usual. They hide in plain sight with uniforms and badges. Spoony, always an agenda. Hi, Mrs. Butler, Barry said, coming over to my mom with her arms out for a hug. Hi, sweetheart. Ain't you supposed to be in school? Ma kissed Barry on the cheek. Barry was in law school. Yep, law school. My dad always got on Spoony, asking him why he wasn't inspired to make something of himself since he dated such a smart girl. Then he'd say, well, at least you got enough sense to get a smart girl. I guess I gotta give you credit for that. I'll put in some extra work at the library this weekend. This is far more important, Barry said. Spoony gave me 5, then he and Barry switched places so he could hug Ma and Barry could hug me. What's up, big man? She said, touching her cheek to mine. Barry was the female version of English. Absolutely gorgeous, and so cool, and smart. Everything wrapped up in one girl, and she was everybody's first crush. Me, Shannon and Carlos, we all loved Barry, and English knew it. We used to tease him so bad about her, and he hated it, but put up with it because that's just what we do. Jokes. But once Spoonie started dating her, we cut all the jokes out, because even though Spoonie wasn't anywhere near perfect, he was definitely a dude who got respect. I don't know why. He just did. It's not like anyone had ever seen him do anything crazy, but he had this presence about him, a confidence that made it seem like he wasn't scared of anything or anybody. So the Barry jokes were over, and she instantly fell into Big Sister zone. "How you holding up?" she asked now. "Oh, you know me, living a luxurious life," I said. "Looks like it," Barry replied. But even though she was smiling, I could see the sadness in her eyes. I could see the sadness in everybody's eyes. My mother's, Spoonie's, my friend's, Clarissa's, even the lady on TV who filmed everything, Claudia's. "Shad, I want you to see something," Spoonie said, easing Barry's backpack off her shoulder. He unzipped it, pulled out her laptop. "They got Wi-Fi in here?" "I don't think so," I said, wanting to laugh at him. I don't know why, but I just thought that was so funny. He put the laptop back in the bag. "Here, just use my phone," Barry said, digging in her back pocket. She tapped the screen a few times, then handed it to Spoonie, who handed it to me. "Look at this." On the screen was a picture of my school, and on the sidewalk was some writing. I enlarged the image and did a double take. "Rashad is absent again today," is what it said, spray painted in bright blue loopy letters. "What is this?" I asked, staring. "There's major buzz about this thing, man. Facebook, Twitter, everywhere. People are pissed off. Kids your age. They're speaking up, man." I stared at the picture. The letters. The tiny loop at the stop of the cursive S. So familiar. There was only one person I knew who did that. Carlos. English texted me earlier saying that some of the kids at your school have been talking about a protest. He sent me that picture, Barry said. But that's not the only one. She reached for the phone and began swiping through photos, showing me picture after picture of "Rashad is absent again today," tagged all over the city. I knew the first one was from Carlos, but not all the rest of them, because I didn't recognize the lettering. Plus, they were too loose. Amateur. I had no idea who those were from. "There's even a hashtag," she said. "Hashtag Rashad is absent again today." I couldn't believe it. I had become a hashtag. I had become searchable. A trending topic. Another number on someone's chart. But to me, I was still just me. A protest? I thumbed the screen, going from picture to picture. It just seemed weird that there was so much fuss over me. "Yeah, man," Spoonie confirmed. "A protest?" my mother repeated, her eyebrows knitting together. "I don't know about this. I don't want nobody else getting hurt." A fierce look came over Spoonie's face. "Ma, we have a right to protest. We have a right to be upset." "I know that, Spoonie. You don't think I know that?" Ma's voice rose. Spoonie had no idea that our mom had just called the cop an asshole. He'd missed that. "You don't think I'm angry?" She glared at him, burned straight through his hoodie. "I know you are. Sorry," he said, humbled. "I'm just so tired of this." "I am too," Ma said, coming back down. "And I know protests can be good. Just like I know that not all cops are bad. I married one."
"I'm not sure Dad's the best example of a good cop," Spoonie said, quicker than quick, the words sharp enough to cut.
Ma gave him a look, not upset, but sad. Like she was sad that her son seemed so angry, so distrusting. And she didn't even say anything to refute his statement, didn't even argue with him, which to me was strange.
"Why not?" I asked.
Spoonie looked from me to Ma before brushing the whole thing off with, "Nothing. Doesn't matter."
"Listen, I just don't want them to find a reason to beat more people, to kill people."
Mom refocused the conversation, her eyes back on me.
"And since apparently they don't trust us, I don't trust them."
"But Ma, all we want is to feel like we can be who we are without being accused of being something else. That's all," Spoonie tried again.
"But do protests even work?" I asked. "I mean, I was all for the idea. I really was. but the only time I had ever heard about any protests actually working was Dr. King's. That's it. Ain't never heard of no other ones making a difference.
Do they work? Spoonie looked at me crazy. How could I even ask such a question look?
Barry stepped in. They're a piece to the puzzle. I mean, there are a lot of pieces, like reforming laws and things like that. But protests are what sends the message to the folks in power that something needs to change, that people are fed up, she explained. We have a right to voice how we feel, and isn't that better than just doing nothing?
Spoonie and Barry tag-teamed me with more political activism mumble-jumble than I could stand, until at last, thank God, English, Shannon, and Carlos showed up. They all hugged my mom and Barry and dapped up Spoonie.
Yo, you heard about the protest?
Carlos shot off instantly, picking up right where my brother and Barry had left off.
Hashtag Rashad is absent again today.
I looked at him. He looked at me. Friendship, ESP.
So this thing is really gonna happen? I asked.
Dude, even Tiffany was talking about it in Mr. Fisher's class, English said. Mr. Fisher was a history teacher at the school. Kind of a weird guy, but still super cool. White hair, jacked up bowl cut, weird cloth ties, shirt tucked in tight jeans. But he knew all about history and would celebrate Black History Month in February and March. The only other teacher who was down for stuff like that was Mrs. Tracy, the English teacher. Shannon and Carlos used to always joke about how Mr. Fisher and Mrs. Tracy were probably dating, probably having gross sex after school on Mrs. Tracy's desk, on top of Shakespeare's sonnets or something.
For real?
I asked.
Yeah, man, Fisher's really supporting it, like he's helping us plan it and everything.
English was gassed.
He kept saying how we are part of history. How this is part of history.
Word?
Is he giving out extra credit for it?
I joked, just to try to lighten the mood.
Shad, we serious, man, Carlos said.
Like, for real.
Told you, Shad, Spoonie said.
This thing is bubbling. People are sick of it.
He looked at Ma, who seemed caught somewhere between mad and worried.
Ma, seriously, what if he was killed?
But he wasn't, she said,
straight, the same way my dad had said a few days before when Spoonie said the same thing.
But what about all the others? Spoonie said. Matter of fact, how many of y'all been messed with by the cops?
Man, what?
I've been pulled over so many times, Carlos said.
Because you speed, I jumped in.
Yeah, true. But at least 3 times they made me get out the car while they tore it apart looking for drugs or guns or whatever they thought I had. Then when they didn't find nothing, they let me go with a speeding ticket, but left my car a mess. Glove compartment emptied out, trunk all dug through, just trashed my ride for no reason.
Man, I've been stopped on the street, English said.
You have?
Barry sparked up.
Yeah, more than once, too. Cops wanting me to lift my shirt so they could see if I had weapons on me, pat downs and all that.
Why didn't you tell me? Barry asked.
Because I already know what time it is. I seen it before, so it was nothing. Plus, I didn't want you freaking out.
At least yours were only pat-downs. One time they had me face down on the sidewalk on Overlook Street.
Said they got word that there was a robbery and said the description of the person was 5'9", dark-skinned with a black t-shirt and black sneakers on, Shannon explained.
That could have been anybody.
That could have been any kid I work with at the rec center. Matter of fact, that could have been me, Spoonie chimed in.
Exactly, Barry agreed.
And I wish the story stopped there. I really did. But they didn't. They went on and on, story after story about not trusting police officers because they always seemed to act like bullies. And even though there were times when they'd been helpful, the bad times were bad times. And it just seemed like they didn't. I don't know. Like, they see us, but they don't really see us.
Okay, I said. Okay, what? Spoonie asked.
Okay, I'm down with the protest.
I have to admit, I said I was down, but I wasn't really sure I meant it. I was scared.
And it's not like they needed me to sign on. This wasn't really about me. This was bigger than me. I knew that now. But I wanted my brother and my friends to know, since the spotlight was on me, that I was in. That I would stand with them.
That is, if I could get out of the hospital.
Name a word that rhymes with grain.
Pain! Good answer! Good answer!
Wednesday. Quinn. Willie was dragging his ass again on Wednesday morning, but truthfully it wasn't all his fault. I was kind of dragging my ass too, still dwelling on all the things I'd been talking to Jill about the night before. It's not like I was dreaming about it. It was more that weird state where your eyes are closed, and you know you were thinking, and it feels like you are both asleep and not, like you're resting, but still thinking, kind of in control of your thoughts, and kind of not. Well, the days carried right over into morning like I was sleepwalking, and when Willie and I finally made it down the steps to head off to school, it might as well have been a dream, because standing on the sidewalk a few houses down, having just lugged the garbage to the street, was Paul Galuzzo, staring right at me. He waved to me, and I waved back, automatically, out of habit. What was I doing? He jogged up to us, and I kept thinking, all I had to do was turn and walk away. What the hell is wrong with me? He looked like he hadn't slept in days. Maybe he hadn't. Maybe he'd been up all night, too, thinking about what he had done to Rashad. Poor guy. Yup, that was my first actual thought. Not Rashad. Paul. Jesus. What's up, Collins? He said when he got to us. Hey, I mumbled. All that normalcy was gone. He sniffled, and I wasn't sure if it was one of those things a guy like him did before he socked a guy like me in the face. I gripped Willie's hand. Paul tussled Willie's hair. He glanced back and forth between Willie and me, and I focused on the grease stain on Paul's t-shirt. Hey, he said. I thought we were going to practice some footwork. He didn't sound angry, more like he was pleading. I'm right here, man. Yeah, I said again, fishing for words. Look, I know. It's been busy, and we have to get to school and all. Hey, he said, now with more force. Don't bullshit me. This made Willie jump a little, and Paul calmed down. No, listen, he said, easy like old times. Little Goose has been telling me about all the chatter at school. Ah, I said, not sure what to say. It's nothing. No, Paul said. No, it's not. It's weird. I know it. He hesitated, and I couldn't find a word to fill the silence. I just wanted to turn and run, but I had Willie holding me there like an anchor, or maybe it was me. What the hell did I want him to say? You gotta hear my side of the story. That was the last thing I wanted to do. I know, I stuttered, but... No, listen, you do. Paul clamped my shoulder with his hand. He raised the other one slowly and pointed close to my face, scabs still tattooing his knuckles. Because you were there. I know. Willie looked up at me. What's going on? Paul sniffled again. His eyes were bloodshot, his hair a mess. He was wearing flip-flops, and I'd never seen him in those stupid things. He let go of me and stood back, his hands on his hips. Look, he said. People tell a lot of fucked up stories. People are talking about me. Well, I'm telling you this. There was a woman in the store. The kid took her down because she caught him stealing. I went in to protect her, and then he went after me, okay? He wiped a hand over his head and then held his fist in front of his mouth for a moment. What was I supposed to do? It's my job, Quinn. I was protecting the lady. I was just doing my job. He reached out to me again but didn't grab me. Just kind of touched my shoulder, like he wasn't sure what he was doing. I leaned back and his fingers fell away awkwardly. I know, I lied. I hear you. Do you? Paul's face was all screwed up. I don't think you do, Quinn. What the hell's the matter with you, man? I know, it's just... I couldn't find anything else to say. I have to get this guy to school. I nodded to Willie. Catch you later, though. Right? Paul's look of disgust ripped a hole in my chest. Are you serious, Quinn? I shrugged and Paul narrowed his eyes. Yeah, he said, turning around and waving me off. See you later. But really, it sounded like he was saying, fuck you. And for the whole walk to Willie's middle school and then to my school, all I could hear was that lie in his voice. He didn't want to see me later. No friggin' way. I didn't want to see him either. But what was worse was that I couldn't believe he'd told me about what happened in the store. Or actually, it wasn't that I couldn't believe that he told me. It was that I couldn't believe what he told me. Because even if Rashad did everything Paul said he did, really? I saw what I saw on the street. That was the real story. I met Jill on the front steps by the tag. What had once been a non-hang at school had now become the hang at school. Everybody stood around the spray-painted slogan. The school maintenance crew hadn't washed it off, and what made it all the more powerful was that it was still true. Rashad had been in the hospital 5 nights, and he was still there. Rashad was absent again today. On either side of the spray paint, kids passed out flyers. A black fist rose from the bottom of each sheet and called for justice. It was what Jill had been talking about. She was organizing, getting involved, and she was there with Tiffany, handing them out. I didn't have Mr. Fisher for history like they did, but I knew who he was, and I saw him out there too, his bright white head bobbing through the crowd of students. Jill now told me in detail what was going down. A community group, a church, and some of the student clubs at school were planning a protest march on Friday. It would start on the west side, go right by Jerry's, and wind its way through town to City Hall and Police Plaza 1. The march through town would begin at 5:30 p.m., approximately the same time Rashad had been arrested for petty theft, resisting arrest, and public nuisance, whatever the hell that meant. And just as I was thinking about it, I heard someone else ask it, "Will Rashad be there?" Nobody knew. At the bell, Jill and I took off in different directions. I tried to catch up with Toombs, but he ignored me and hustled ahead of me into our English classroom. When I walked into class behind him, Mrs. Tracy stood at the window looking down over the front steps in the entrance to the school. Even when everyone had taken their seats, she remained by the window, and the rest of the class kept talking, waiting for her to go to her desk. But she didn't. In her hand, she held her copy of the novel The Invisible Man. A week earlier, she'd made photocopies of the first chapter, a short story Ralph Ellison published as Battle Royal. That story, I'd never read anything like it. The violence, the all-out warfare, the N-word all over the place. When it had been assigned a week earlier, I'd read it all twisted up in discomfort, like the actual reading of the story was painful. But now, as Mrs. Tracy clutched her book and looked down to the sidewalk, a kind of nervousness rose in me. I'd hated the way the old white men in the story had acted, watching black boys getting beaten, beating each other for sport. And I'd put as much distance between them and me as I could. I wasn't them, I'd told myself as I read. White people were crazy back then, 80 years ago, when the story took place. Not now. But watching Mrs. Tracy stare out the window, a weight of dread dropped through me. Were we going to talk about the story again after Rashad? Because after what had happened to Rashad, it felt like no time had passed at all. It could have been 80 years ago, or only 8. Now it wasn't only the city alderman, now there were the videos. And we were all watching this shit happen again and again on our TVs and phones, shaking our heads but doing nothing about it. Mrs. Tracy still didn't move from the window. And everyone began to fidget, looking at everyone else. And my eyes landed on the whiteboard. Her notes from what must have been her last period class the day before were still on it. Active versus passive voice. I remembered the exact same lesson from 9th grade. I thought it was all a pain in the ass, but what had once been a stupid grammar lesson now formed a weird lump in my throat. "Mistakes were made," Mrs. Tracy had scrawled. And beneath it, she'd written, "Who? Who made the mistakes?" In my mind, I ran through the exercise I remembered from the time, rearranging the phrases, making something passive active. But this time I found myself changing the other words too, because I was clearly becoming obsessed, even if I didn't want to be. Mistakes were made. Rashad was beaten. Paul beat Rashad. Mrs. Tracy finally moved from the window and did something just as surprising. She sat down behind her desk. Usually she walked around her desk or she perched on the front of her desk, but she never sat. Now slumped behind it, she never looked so small. the whiteboard as big as the sky over her tiny, hunched shoulders. I thought she was about to begin the lesson, but she pushed the book away from her on the desk and began to cry. I clenched my jaw tight and stared down at the floor, trying not to let her tears make me cry back in response. I just sat there breathing heavily through my nose. She pointed to the window and dropped her head into her hands. "I don't want to see this happen to any of my students," she said, catching her breath. "I don't want to believe it still happens." I gripped one hand with the other, hoping to disappear. I wasn't the only one. The room had never been so quiet. No one spoke or whispered. Mrs. Tracy just sat there with her head in her hands. After a few last sobs, she apologized. "I'm sorry for my outburst. It's just..." And then the tears came again, and she apologized again and continued. "Mr. Godwin thinks it's best if I don't assign papers for this story. He thinks it's best to just move on to the next unit." Something felt off about that. Don't get me wrong, nobody wants to write a paper if he doesn't have to. But this time, it felt like we were getting cheated out of something. Everyone still kept absolutely silent, but I wondered what was going through Toombs's mind. He was nodding a slow, hesitant nod, an "I read you" kind of nod. I leaned back in my chair but couldn't actually go anywhere because the damn thing was all one unit and I felt trapped. It was too damn small for me anyway. And as I was sitting there, shifting around in that tiny-ass chair desk, I remembered Mrs. Tracy making fun of Mr. Godwin, saying she'd never follow what the department head or the administration wanted her to teach. But now, suddenly, when they actually did direct her, she was blaming them for not talking about the book. And then I thought about what was right there in the text. Ralph Ellison talking about invisibility. Not the wacky science fiction kind, but the kind where people are looking at you, but not seeing you. Looking through you or around you. Like, why the hell shouldn't our classes be talking about what happened to Rashad? Was what happened to him invisible? Was he invisible? I scribbled a note. "I might be an asshole, but I know this isn't right. Should we do something? The invisible man at Central High, Rashad." I tore the note from my notebook, wadded it, and threw it at Toombs. The crumbled ball bounced off his desk, into his chest, and onto the ground. He squinted at me. "Read it," I mouthed. He hesitated, but then he snatched it up and smoothed it out. He stared at the note for what seemed like forever, and then he looked back up at me. "You with me?" he mouthed back. I nodded. Then for the first time ever in any class I'd ever been in with him, Toombs spoke up without being called on. "Battle Royal," he said, pulling his photocopy out of his folder. "For Rashad." And he began to read. "It goes a long way back, some 20 years. All my life I had been looking for something, and everywhere I turned, someone tried to tell me what it was." Now, Toombs is not a read-out-loud kind of guy, but he went right into it, reading clear and confident for the whole room to hear, and it made the most perfect sense reading the words Ralph Ellison had written years ago. Mrs. Tracy lifted her head, her face a mess. And something about her crying there in class made me so mad. Like Rashad's reality meant now she couldn't talk about the story or didn't know how. But there was Ralph Ellison and Toombs, too. Just telling us what we needed to do. I unfolded my crinkled pages and followed along as Toombs read aloud, ending with a final line of the first paragraph. "It took me a long time and much painful boomeranging of my expectations to achieve a realization everyone else appears to have been born with, that I am nobody but myself. But first I had to discover that I am an invisible man." When Toombs fell silent, I glanced back, and I realized he was looking at me. I nodded, and even though I'm not the kind of guy who likes to read aloud either, I hate it. The rest of the room just sat there waiting for something to happen, and even Mrs. Tracy was stunned. So I jumped into the next paragraph. The lines were the old grandfather's deathbed advice talking about his life after slavery, his life still struggling. "Learn it to the youngins. His final fiercely whispered words. And it seemed like the words were calling right into the classroom. They weren't my words, they were Ellison's. But there he was reminding us all what had to be learned by the youngins. Then it was my time to be surprised because Nam picked up where I left off. And after Nam, Sonya read. Then Latrice and Alex. And soon it was clear the whole class was going to take a turn because what would it say if you didn't? Mrs. Tracy watched and listened. She didn't interrupt. The slurs and the violence from the dialogue ricocheted around the room. Some people skipped over them. Some people said line of dialogue. Chloe looked up, tears streaming down her own white face, and said, "I don't want to say these words." And nobody judged. We just waited to see what she would do. Some people said it all, word for word. But here are the words that kept ricocheting around me all day. Nobody says the words anymore. But somehow, the violence still remains. If I didn't want the violence to remain, I had to do a hell of a lot more than just say the right things and not say the wrong things. Practice was better than it had been in a couple of days. Coach drilled us with a few plays that made us run laps, then dropped the three-point contest on us. It was no surprise that I won because I'd been hitting threes since I was a freshman. I used my legs to shoot like Paul had taught me. But I didn't think about him as I shot. I kept my head where it was supposed to be, in the moment, even when we scrimmaged. Coach was trying out different combinations of players, and although he didn't say it, he was evaluating who was going to be a starter for sure. At first I played against English, then I got swapped briefly, and when I went back in, I was on his team. I was nervous, but a shooter has to shoot. I hit the first one I took on a pass from him, and on the very next play, we had a 2-on-1 against Toombs. And although English might have taken it to the hoop against Toombs, he kicked it to me for the easy basket. I got him later too when I dropped the ball around Guzzo. English and I had a rhythm going, and I knew that if we kept it up for the next few months, we'd both be breaking records. I mean, hell, why couldn't the scouts be here now, when English and I were playing so well together? But no game is ever that easy. 10 minutes before practice was supposed to end, Guzzo and Toombs went up for a rebound, and Toombs knocked Guzzo in the face with his elbow. Guzzo bucked backwards, spun, and stumbled down to one knee. Coach blew his whistle and we all stopped, but already, Guzzo was springing to his feet and shoving Toombs. Toombs pushed him back, and Nam and I got in between them before either of them threw a punch. "What the hell's the matter with you two?" Coach barked. He pulled us all apart. And for a split second, it seemed like Guzzo and Toombs were going to go at it again. But Coach got each of them by the collars of their shirts. "There's no room for that bullshit here." "He jacked me," Guzzo said. A line of blood dropped from his nose to his shirt. "It was an accident," Toombs said. "No, it wasn't," Guzzo shot back. "Enough," Coach told them, letting go of their shirts. "Take it easy." He stared at Toombs. "It was an accident. Right?" "Of course." "Bullshit," Guzzo interrupted. "Everyone has it out for me." Coach rubbed his jaw. "All right, look, enough of that." He looked around at all of us. "You think it's dumb when someone says there's no I in team, but you stick one in there and you see how dumb that looks." Guzzo took a step back, but Coach waved him closer. "Bring it in, boys." We all hesitated. "I said, bring it in," he yelled. So we piled in around him, and he stuck his hand in the middle. We followed, like we always did. "I get it, there's a lot of bullshit out there, and it needs to be resolved, but we're not resolving it in here, not in practice, and not on this court. We leave all that bullshit at the door. In here, on this court, we need to win games. That's all we need to do, and we need to work like one team or we're fucked, you hear me? We've got all kinds of people coming to see us. They start coming next week. Next week. You ready for that? The press? The scouts? When is the last time those guys from Duke were here? You hear me?" A couple guys said yes, but the rest of us merely nodded. Guzzo leaned on my back, but I was looking across the circle at English and Shannon. I got what Coach was saying. I wanted to see teammates, but it got me thinking. Maybe right now all I saw were teammates around me, but once we stepped back into the real world, who did I see? Who did they see? Coach could keep shouting at us until we all parroted back what he wanted, but I knew English and Shannon answered because they had to, not because they wanted to. Tombs, too. And that's what I was doing, too, because Coach kept telling us to leave everything else at the door, but I was thinking about it the other way around. How did the team stay a team back out the door? How did the team stay a team out in the street? Guto's nose kept bleeding right through all the yelling, so Coach told me to get him into the locker room and cleaned up. Then Coach blew his whistle. The scrimmage started again with new combinations, and the squeaking of sneakers and the ball in the court followed me into the locker room. Guto jogged ahead of me, not saying a word, while he washed his face and grabbed a couple paper towels. He walked around to a bench deeper in the locker room, sat, and held his head back. I leaned against a nearby locker and crossed my arms. He didn't hit you on purpose. Yeah, he did. Come on. People have it all backward. They do, Guto said. He wiped out his nose and then pinched it closed again. Look, he said, I'm sorry, but my brother did the right thing. He has to make tough calls. I'm sorry they're friends with that guy, but what are you gonna do? I mean, Paul, he was helping the woman in the store. He didn't do anything wrong. He was doing his job. But that's not how everyone sees it, man. Yeah, but that doesn't mean they're right. But what? Guto wiped at his nose again and raised his voice. But what? Whose side are you on here? Come on. You heard Coach, I said. No sides. No sides, asshole. Of course there are sides. There are two sides to every situation. His nose started bleeding again, so I got him another paper towel. He wiped at his nose again. It still bled. I got him another paper towel, but he just held it in his hand. They could call you for a witness, couldn't they? Maybe, I said. I was feeling paranoid about this, because ever since my conversation with Jill, I kept thinking that I had to do it. I had to let someone know. And then what, stand in a courtroom and point my finger at Paul? I couldn't even imagine doing that. I don't know how it works, though, I continued. Anyway, everyone's seen the video. It was taken from a spot closer than I was. But if they called you, what would you say? I was silent. Before anybody would call me into some freaking courtroom, I'd have to tell somebody official that I was there. Whose side are you on? Guto asked again. And when I didn't answer him, he continued. Everyone's got to get their heads out of their asses. We're not a team. If Tombs or anybody else is going to clock me every chance he gets. No, man, the problem is assuming he's out to get you. He isn't. Guto pinched his nose again and tipped his head back. I don't need a fucking nurse, he said. Get out of here. I know whose side you're on, and I'm going to tell my brother how you don't have his back. After all he did for you, man, fuck you. He stood, and I backed away. Even with a bloody nose, Guto could drop me in a heartbeat. It's about doing the right thing, Guto said mockingly. I hate all this politically correct bullshit. Nobody'd be spray-painting your name on the sidewalk if Paul had grabbed you coming out of Jerry's. He punched a locker with the side of his fist. Half the school is calling my brother a racist. He was just doing his job. People throw that word racist around all the time now. Pretty soon, everyone's going to start calling me a racist if I don't pass Tombs the ball. It's fucked up, and you know it. Guto, I said, you're not the victim. Your brother isn't either. The look on his face went fierce, and I was glad as hell that Coach began bringing the rest of the team into the locker room. He called out to us, and we reluctantly joined him and the rest of the guys around the bench closest to the showers. One more time, bring it in, boys, Coach said. We're all in this together. He looked at Guto, then at Tombs. Sorry, Tombs said to Guto through his teeth. Galuzzo? Coach prompted. Yeah, yeah, Guto said. Me too. Then he pulled the bloody paper towel away from his face and wadded it into a hard ball. We're good, right? He said across the circle to Tombs. He smiled sarcastically. If the rest of us had melted away and Coach had disappeared, I think Toombs would have leaped across the bench and punched Guzzo straight in the face, for real, this time. I wouldn't have blamed him. But what the hell, didn't that make me a traitor to my best friend? Hey, I said to Guzzo, it's over. Guzzo glared at me. Damn straight, he said.
That's right, Coach said. And we're a team, and we need to take care of each other. You know the rules. We take care of each other on the court and off it. We don't go to parties, and we help make sure no one else on the team goes to them either. No one needs to be stupid. We've got 4 months to show the world we're number one. No parties and no protests. You hear me?
Some of the guys nodded.
I said, you hear me?
Yes,
we yelled automatically.
Mean it! Yes! Again! Yes!
He stuck his hand in and we followed.
Okay, team on three. 1, 2, 3. Team!
We all shouted. Lying just to get the damn practice finished. Team? Maybe. Like the whole school is a team? The whole city is a team? But we weren't one just because we called ourselves one. We had to mean it to be it. And to be it, maybe we had to talk about the tough shit out loud. Otherwise, we just keep lying to each other all the time. Lying. Paul wasn't the only one.
Rashad. Dear Cadet Butler, I had planned to come visit you, but it was communicated to me that you didn't want any visitors. And in tough times like these, I can totally understand you wanting as much privacy as possible, and have encouraged your fellow cadets to also respect your wishes. Nonetheless, I wanted you to know your comrades and I have you in our thoughts and wish you a speedy recovery and return to the program. And to encourage you in this time, I've enclosed a card with our creed. All the best, Chief Killebrew. I am an Army Junior ROTC cadet. I will always conduct myself to bring credit to my family, country, school, and the Corps of Cadets. I am loyal and patriotic. I am the future of the United States of America. I do not lie, cheat, or steal, and will always be accountable for my actions and deeds. I will always practice good citizenship and patriotism. I will work hard to improve my mind and strengthen my body. I will seek the mantle of leadership and stand prepared to uphold the Constitution and the American way of life. May God grant me the strength to always live by this creed. If you're wondering if I had been having nightmares, you know, about that day, the answer is no. I hadn't been. Not until Wednesday. Actually, it started Tuesday night after my friends and family left my room, and I decided to finally read Chief Killebrew's card. I couldn't figure out if he had inserted the creed as some kind of reminder to me that if I'm guilty to fess up, and that I was expected to never lie and steal or what. Maybe he really was trying to encourage me. Maybe he was saying that because I was a cadet. There was no way I could be guilty. I don't know. I just know that it rubbed me in a weird way because ROTC, especially the people like my dad, was the first step to the military and ultimately into law enforcement. I mean, for all I knew, Galuzzo could have been in ROTC when he was my age. Was he the future of America? Was he upholding the American way of life? I guess it depends on who you ask. Maybe. And maybe it was these thoughts rattling around my head that sparked the nightmare. I was back in Jerry's, but in the dream, the chips were located in the drink fridge. So I'm standing at the refrigerator staring through the glass when I hear a voice coming from behind me.
I know what you're doing,
the voice said. For some reason, I didn't turn around. I just looked into the glass to see the reflection of whoever was there. And it was him, Officer Galuzzo, like Goliath standing with his hand already on his weapon, sizing me up. I ain't doing nothing, I said, still facing the glass.
I know what you're doing, he repeated, taking a step closer, the sound of his boots thumping on the vinyl floor.
I knew I should have turned around, but I couldn't. I was frozen, but I could still see him through the glass, his mirrored image becoming clearer as he got closer and closer. Then I adjusted my eyes to see my own reflection, my own face. But I couldn't. I mean, my face was there, but it wasn't. There were no eyes, no nose or mouth, just blank brown skin. And that's when I woke up, my heart pounding, my throat scratchy and dry. The dream seemed to last 5 minutes, but it had actually been hours, and it was now Wednesday morning. I reached over to the food tray beside my bed for the leftover cranberry juice from dinner the night before. In hospitals, juice comes in the same kind of cups as fruit cocktails and applesauce, the ones where you have to peel back the foil. Damn things are hard to open. My hands, for some weird reason, were weak, wouldn't work right. Maybe it was the dream. Maybe it was everything that was going on, the reality. Whatever it was, I struggled to pull the aluminum seal back far enough to take a sip of juice, and I needed it. My throat felt like I had eaten my blanket. I pulled and peeled until finally the stupid foil snapped away from the plastic and cranberry juice spilled all over the place. Of course. I snatched the wet sheet back. There was still some juice left, so I decided to get what I could. Right when I took a sip, there was a knock on my door. Now, I know it was probably just a regular knock, but at that moment, it sounded like a bang, and I was so jittery that I spilled whatever was left of the juice on myself.
Shit, I grumbled.
Watch your mouth. My father was pushing the door open. He poked his head in, a strange thing that everyone does at the hospital for some reason, before entering. Good morning, he said, eyeing me as I dabbed juice into my gown, the burgundy blotches on my chest and stomach looking like blood. Hey, I said, what time is it?
Just about 7.
Why are you here so early? Dad closed the door behind him and came to the foot of the bed.
Wanted to catch you before I went to work, see how you were doing.
Oh, I said, kind of shocked. I'm okay, how about you? Mom told me you were sick.
Yeah, something didn't agree with my system, but I'm fine. He sat on the edge of the bed, which was different for him.
Usually he sat in a chair on the other side of the room, as far away from me as possible. Cool. I wasn't really sure what else to say. Dad sat there staring at the side table where my phone and the spirometer were.
Listen, he started. I want to tell you a story. When I was a cop.
Pause.
Here's the thing. My father has 3 different ways to start a parental sermon about a whole bunch of I don't want to hear it. 1, when I was your age, always about how he was doing way more than I am when he was in high school. Let him tell it, he put the principal in detention. 2, when I was in the army, always came whenever I was tired. It didn't matter what I was tired from. If I showed any signs of exhaustion, he would hit me with how when he was in the army, he wasn't allowed to be tired, and that if he even yawned, they made him drop down and give them 1,000 push-ups. And 3, when I was a cop, always came whenever he was either defending cops or insulting teenagers. When I was a cop, he started. He reached up and loosened his navy blue tie. Then he hiked his khaki pants up, just enough to show his tan socks, peppered with dark brown diamonds. Office clothes are as boring as offices. Anyway, I braced myself and prepared to ignore whatever was coming.
One time, he began, I got a call that there were a few guys making a bunch of noise in the middle of the night over on the east side. You know how it is over there. 9 o'clock, that whole neighborhood shuts down. Now, I was used to these quick runs. You drive up, hit your lights and your siren, and if the kids don't take off running, you just roll down the window and tell them to keep it moving. Never really a big deal.
My father was still staring at the spirometer, as if he was talking to it, as if I wasn't in the room.
So my partner and I answer the call and head on over. When we pull up, there's a white kid in tight black jeans and a sweater, and this black kid going for it. A backpack was upside down on the side of the curb, and these two were just throwing down, scrapping. The black kid was dressed like, he looked at me finally, dressed like your brother. Hair all over his head, a hoodie, boots. His pants were damn near all the way down. And he was mopping this boy. My partner and I jumped out of the car and approached him. And before we could even give him a chance to stop fighting, I ran over and jacked the black boy up because I knew he was in the wrong. I just knew it. I mean, you should have seen how he was pummeling this kid. And he fought me back, telling me that I had it wrong. He slipped right from my grip and ran for the backpack. I pulled my gun, told him to leave it. He kept yelling, I didn't do anything, I didn't do anything, he's the criminal. but now he's wheezing like he was having a hard time speaking. Then he grabbed the backpack. By now, my partner's got the white kid. I tell the black dude to leave the bag and put his hands up, but he doesn't, and instead opens it, puts his hand inside, and before he could pull it out, I pulled the trigger.
Holy shit! What?
I yelped. I had never heard this story, and I thought I had heard all the stories. I heard all the ones about the people he saved, the woman who had been beaten by her husband, the high-speed chase of a bank robber, who Dad eventually caught after running him off the road movie style. I had heard all the stories about how Dad had been shot at, and definitely the one about how he had been shot. I saw the bullet wound in his chest every morning when he got out of the shower, like a tiny crater or a third nipple, a symbol of near death. But I had never, ever, ever heard this one. Dad's Adam's apple rolled down his throat, then back up. Then he continued. He was reaching for his inhaler. Turns out he lived in that neighborhood and was walking home late when the white kid tried to rob him. He was trying to fight the kid off. And when we showed up, his adrenaline went so high that he couldn't breathe. Asthma attack. So he had to get to his inhaler. But he was having a hard time telling me that. I just assumed he... Wait. Wait. I put my hand up, pushing the words back into my father's mouth. If there was ever a time that I needed, for once, to control a conversation with him, it was now. I only had one question. Did you kill him? No. Dad teethed his top lip, but I paralyzed him from the waist down. I just sat there, dumbfounded. My dad, had paralyzed an unarmed kid, a black kid, and I had no idea. My dad shot a kid. I mean, to me, my father was the model of discipline and courage. Sure, he was stern and sometimes judgmental, but I always felt like he meant well. But to that kid, and now my head was reeling, to that kid, my dad was no different than Officer Galuzzo. Another trigger-happy cop who was quick to assume and even quicker to shoot. My father filled in the silence my lack of verbal response had created. You know, you were still very young, but Spoonie remembers it all. The news, the drama. I'm not proud of it. It'll never stop haunting me. And I think it messes with your brother still, too. It probably messes with that boy's... What's his name? I asked, hard. Darnell Shackelford, he rattled off. It was clearly a name he couldn't forget. It probably still messes with Darnell and his family, too. Right, Dad nodded sadly. Thing is, I had been in so many other situations where things had gotten crazy. A hand goes in a pocket and out comes a pistol or a blade. And all I could think about was making it home to you, Spoonie, and your mother. It's a hard job. A really hard job, and you could never understand that. You could never know what it's like to kiss your family goodbye in the morning, knowing you could get a call over your radio that could end your life. I could hear the struggle in his voice. Like, he really wanted me to understand this. And part of me did. Part of me could even appreciate knowing he thought of us every time he left the house. But still. Then why did you choose to be a cop? Believe it or not, I wanted to do some good. I really did. But then I realized after a while that most of the time, I was walking into situations expecting to find a certain kind of criminal. I was looking for me? Dad reached over and picked up the spirometer and started inspecting it from every angle. He couldn't say it, and instead just finished the story. So I quit the force. He took a deep breath, and I got the feeling that he felt both relieved and ashamed that he had gotten that off his chest. Look, all I'm trying to say is that not all cops are bad. I know that. I hadn't even noticed, mainly because of my nervousness, that the foil from the juice cup, I had taken it and rolled it between my thumb and pointer fingers over and over again until it had become a perfectly round pellet, a tiny, uncrushable thing. As a matter of fact, most cops are good. I work with a lot of great guys, really trying to make a difference. You need to know that they're not all wolves.
Dad, I do.
But not all kids who look and dress like me are bad either. Most of them aren't. And even the ones who are don't deserve to be killed.